So here's a song by David Rovics called It's Legal Now, about which he writes, on November 6, 2012, Colorado and Washington voted to legalize cannabis for recreational use. Oregon and other states would soon follow. Oddly enough, for the country that is normally leading the way for all the wrong reasons, torture, predatory loans, deregulated banks, private prisons, solitary confinement, fracking, and so on, as a result of the phenomenon of state referendums, it's sometimes possible to subvert corporate rule and engage in a little actual democracy every once in a while. And thus, some U.S. states became global hotspots in the international struggle against cannabis prohibition, itself a phenomenon largely led by the U.S. in the early 20th century, primarily just to have one more foot in the toolbox for the police to, in their quest to find ways to keep people of color in check since slavery had ostensibly ended.
For about a century, there was a prohibition, which put a heck of a lot of people in a difficult position. Each year, millions went to prison for planting the wrong seeds, imprisoned for the crime of smoking weed. Imprisoned in their millions, especially those black or brown or wearing long hair and hippie clothes. But I stand here before you with quite a bit of pleasure to tell you all about a successful ballot measure. It's legal now. It's legal now. Take a bow. It's legal now. Politicians were useless, almost all the same, playing the military-industrial prison complex game. But the regular people weren't nearly as dumb, so some folks took initiative and we passed a referendum. Now people don't have to risk arrest if they want to treat their ills with something other than pharmaceutical pills. And if you just want to take a hit because you like the feeling, you can safely walk the streets or just stare up at the ceiling. It's legal now. It's legal now. Take a bow. It's legal now. Now that pot's legit, at least in large parts of the West, we can get to work legalizing all the rest. The poppies and the coca leaves and all the other plants, safer, regulated, will be the official stance. The CIA will have to find another way to operate. The FBI will need a new MO for their whole police state. When we legalize it all, from the West Coast to the East, then we can say right here in the belly of the beast, it's legal now. It's legal now. Take a bow. It's legal now.
So I'm on the line now with Brent Adams, who's just finished, can I say this, Brent, a long period of quarantine yourself, contact with COVID, I assume.
Yes.
And, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a positive test, so I had to go into quarantine.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling still a little bit weak, with the 8 days after getting sick, but I'm feeling good.
So you didn't have to be hospitalized or anything of that sort, or did you?
No, I didn't.
Good. So you said that you're having some concerns about some issues in the city, and you've just recently been speaking to one of the council people?
That's right, Sandy Brown. Mm-hmm.
What was the issue, and what should be...
You've known me for many years. I entered this space after the Occupy movement. I'm not going to give the longest history, but we wanted to do something called a sanctuary camp, and the entire everything I've been doing since then is really was sparked by our un, successful endeavor to build a camp, which is finally now called a transitional camp. It's just essentially a non-profit relationship with the city or county to use public property to have an organized camp according to very specific rules. To date, we have not been able to do it. We've done agreement camps. The community has done what Brent Adams, what I call these large human dumping ground camps. And then the million-dollar camps. Of course, they're the ones at the Armory. The county's done one in the Benchlands, 1220 River Street. And we're going to see another one up at the Armory. But there's an RFQ process following this long outdoor living ordinance process, sparking almost a year ago now after the Battle of the Duck Pond, the city council wanted to. Well, we know the city manager had this plan, and city managers all across the state, to get some sort of criminalization process of people who sleep outside back on the books because of Martin vs. Boise had prevented that. And we understand that's coming, and we understand, you know, we might even understand their desire to do such a thing. But on our side of the fence, you know, we want to create and establish appropriate places for people to be. If they're going to say you can't be over here and we're going to cite you, then let's have ample, good enough places, you know, where they can be.
What evidence do you have, or what indications do you have that this was a statewide effort, other than the fact that it's happening in numerous cities?
Oh, it was one city council meeting at which the city attorney had said we've been counseling with several other cities. And we knew that, and that was uttered in two places. I believe it was uttered at the CATCH meeting, and I also believe it was uttered at a city council meeting. And maybe, do you have any recollection of that at all?
Not specifically, but I got to be honest with you, I have not had the patience to listen through entire city council meetings. It's too much.
We learned that with the Occupy movement, that mayors were in conference calls with, you know, a dozen other mayors to try to figure out how to deal with their large Occupy camps. That had been discovered at Occupy Oakland, where the mayor had said that they were conferring with lots of other mayors. So on issues like this, where the entire state and the entire country is, you know, all of the anti-homeless ordinances just hit the, you know, fall off the book immediately, we would expect that, you know, as soon as one municipality is successful at crafting one, then they're all going to kind of fall in line and write a similar one. They're just trying to figure out how to, how to write this effectively and still not have, legal challenges.
Now, you mentioned three categories of camps, agreement camps, transitional camps, and million-dollar camps.
And
dumping grounds.
Large dumping ground camps.
It's actually four camps.
Yep.
So you want to give us an example of each and tell us which ones are currently in operation?
Okay, well, the large dumping ground camp is just a space where they allow people to be because they don't want them downtown. They don't want them at the post office. They don't want them along the highway. So just think about that one at the post office initially in 2017, and 2017-18, and then the first one at the Benchlands. That's where Chief Mills finally decided to not enforce the camping ban, even though it was still in the books for another year and a half after that. He just stopped. He's one of the first people in the state, I believe, to stop enforcing a camping ban. And so, which means that you're allowed to set up a tent. Firstly, in the Benchlands, they were allowed to, like, lay under a tarp for a while at night, set up the tent, and then break it down in the daytime. Year after year, it gets progressive. 2019, we saw the Ross Camp, which had, you know, literally more than 100, 200 tents in there at its peak that the city just allowed. And what they finally do is put porta-potties and dumpsters in those spaces, kind of like a tacit, you know, almost a hosting of the space. So finally, we saw at the closing of the first Benchlands camp, they started this, what we call the million-dollar camp, which is a managed camp, starting at 1220 River Street, a city property where they hire staff and security guards, a mounting. You might even remember they had a police portable building trailer across the street, staffed 24 hours a day. So it was a very expensive camp initially.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
So they go back, they alternate back and forth between these two extreme poles, a large dumping ground camp. As I call them the dumping ground camps because you can't be anywhere else, so you can be here, but this is the last place you'd want to be. And the reasons being is because if you have a bunch of dealers in a space, and you're coming from, let's say, for example, Live Oak to get your substance, why not, and then there's a camp right next to your dealer, why not move in? And that's what a lot of people did. We saw a lot of people who'd never seen before after the first Benchlands camp into the Ross camp. It increased by magnitude easily at 300%. And a lot of those people are still with us now. They weren't formerly homeless, but they're definitely homeless now. And when we get to last summer, the number of people camping in the Benchlands is just astronomical. Also, you match that with Dakota Landing and the Cat Paradise and Hell's Trail. Unimaginable numbers of people now, and most of them, and people can disagree with me, most of them are there, servicing in some sort of substance use disorder. So then you get the camp that we see up at the Armory, with that associated, that you have the city and the county trying to focus on the pandemic, trying to get people in the safe spaces. It's another type of managed camp. Agreement camps popped up alongside because we were trying to get people out of these very dangerous spaces. I assert they're dangerous because lowest common behaviors are enforced in these spaces. When you don't have a set of rules, you don't have a community to support and protect people, things get really, really gnarly and get dangerous. And we see a lot of overdoses. We see with fentanyl, things just getting worse and worse. So agreement camps, it's usually a bound, protected space, someplace ideally away from a dumping ground camp like Harvey West. And then finally, a set of agreements. That's been somewhat successful, definitely successful at Harvey West, when they forced that down into the Benchlands, which was the fenced area over the last, late spring, summer, into the fall at Dakota Landing. Southern part of the Benchlands that was fenced, that was most destroyed by the big winter storm surge. And then finally, you have the Camp Paradise, and that's a big conversation about whether that was actually an agreement camp or not. Not really. So then it brings us to transitional camps. This is the thing that we discovered after the Occupy movement up in the Northwest. It's not a managed camp, but it is, technically. It means that instead of hiring staff, we're going to designate all the people who sign up to be residents of the camp, and they take 4 to 10 hour week duties, and they manage the space themselves under very close support, shepherding with a nonprofit, under very specific rules, under contract permit with a city or state. A county. So, for instance, in Eugene, Oregon, you have these camps on city property or private property, and they have a contractual agreement with the city. No one's hired to be there. All the residents watch the gate. It's very strict. So when people are finally managing their own space, we've seen that they do a really good job of it. But currently, so we've been advocating for that since 2013. Being prevented to do that, we've done all kinds of other things, Warming Center and the Footbridge Services Center and all of that. We've been able to do these agreement camps, but recently, because of the folly within the city government, the TOLO, saying that they're going to put people camping in the 4 natural areas and the community coming out, drastically against that. Finally, the next version that they were going to put people in light industrial areas of Seabright, Westside, and Harvey West, and the community coming out very aggressively against that. Finally, they're going to issue these requests for qualifications for nonprofits and faith communities to enter the space to operate programs like transitional camps. Finally, are you still there?
I am. I am still here. Go ahead.
You're very generous and patient.
It's very interesting. Keep it up. Keep it up, Brent.
Brings us to this moment where the city has not met with a contract any of the nonprofits locally who've tried to answer this request for qualifications. The list of opportunities include 24/7 encampment, hygiene program, storage program, an outreach program. We've so far filled out two of these things. Not only were we denied, we weren't even given an answer to the fact that we were denied. We were met with complete silence. The worst thing of all, finally, is that the city, on the day of the city council meeting, that they were going to notify city council of their transitional camp. We thought for sure we were going to have it. Lee Butler indicated that, you know, write it up. It's highly likely that you'll be able to finally, you know, do your Warming Center footbridge transitional camp at 1220 River Street. So we got geared up and got ready to do it. We had a we, you know, filled out an application, and then they notified us the day of the vote that they were going to do their own transitional camp, which is weird because you don't actually want a city running a transitional camp. It doesn't. You need a buffer. That's what the nonprofit in between would be beneficial. In this case, unfortunately, their transitional camp is already off the rails. They don't have that type of structure that can encourage people to manage the space well. They've got Jeremy and Chris Montes, Jeremy Leonard, employees with the city, and they're largely not anywhere near the site. There's no kiosk at the front. The door is never monitored. You really need a desk out there with somebody there 24/7, making sure people aren't coming and going, stealing things, or you know, that people are signing in. That there's a very strict list of rules for when people can visit. It's not, you know, the negative thing that we might imagine, that it's so regulated that you can't bring your friend in, but no overnight guests. And what we're seeing is, so far, reports of lots of theft. Nobody's watching the gate. People are streaming in through the night. The showers are used largely by people who aren't within the camp. We understand why that's necessary, but there are showers at Housing Matters, and also we are serving as many as 60 showers a week with our nonprofit, with the AFC shower trailer. So, unfortunately, but here's the deal. Why didn't Brent Adams and his little nonprofit get access to a city contract to run a transitional camp after all these years, after all of the work we've been doing? And the city really gets to ride for free on all of our work. They don't pay us a penny. We don't get any tax dollars from the city or county. So all the showers, nearly 100 loads of laundry that we're doing weekly now for free, serving hundreds of people, storage, electrical charging, warming center. No one has to sleep outside in the extreme nights. You know, these are just mini rants that I give all the time. But how is the city helping for all this? So finally, I have a conversation. You know, we had interaction with Larry and Wally last month and the month prior with Lee Butler.
He's the homeless czar, right?
Homeless czar and the planning director who has been kind of the homeless manager. Two different people within the city manager's office, and a new city manager who I still wouldn't recognize on the street if I saw him, so I gotta get busy there. It's just, this is our moment, finally, after, you know, and what they've done is everybody from Camp Paradise has now been kicked out without a process. We, as a community, need to be demanding camp displacement policy, that they will help find people another more appropriate place, shoving everybody into the bench lines. If you've been there recently, you'll know it is packed. It's packed beyond packed. People are lining beginning to line the levee. Camp Hills Trail is very packed again. And we really just have been wanting to have conversation with the city.
When was Camp Paradise denuded?
They were notified last week, and they were pushed out fully on Tuesday. We were hoping that wasn't going to happen because, again, there's just no place for people to go to, but they went in there citing people. We're told that they're going to show up with the bulldozers on Monday. we're pretty upset with that, about that, because these are people out here who don't want and shouldn't be in the benchlands. Distinct communities.
How many people would you say this affects?
Well, I think it affected 100 people in the Camp Paradise and Hells Trail area. A lot of people, after the storm surge, went back home. The people who could went to another town. went into the Pogonip, but a lot of people are in crammed into Hell's Trail right now.
How many people would you estimate?
The challenge for me is that here, after all of this, the city had an opportunity to work with Association of Faith Communities, our nonprofit, Warming Center Program.
Before you get into that, Brent, because I want to hear that, how many people are currently in the Hell's Trail, would you estimate?
That's about 50 people.
And so 100 were evicted from the Camp Paradise.
Yep.
And about what? You say they went in various places and mainly packed into the benchlands?
Half of them went up to Hell's Trail, which is just adjacent. And then some went out to the highway front, again, the little corner that they can occupy over that had been occupied last winter, Highway 1.
Is that near the housing?
People are in the Pogonip. People are in the benchlands.
Is that near Housing Matters? That area on Highway 1 you're talking about? Or?
Yeah. So Housing Matters has been completely fenced up to the railroad tracks and the entire track area, but down behind Granite Creek or Granite, whatever that's called, and all the way up the highway that drops down below. And I don't know what street that's called. Limekiln, I guess, maybe?
Could be. I'm not sure either. This is, however, not directly in front of Housing Matters, right?
Nobody's in front of Housing Matters anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we're very proud here. We always call it the Coral Street Effect, that we work really hard to keep Selka Street unkempt. We for all the services that we provide, we're also your local neighborhood NIMBY. Because we're trying to reduce negative impacts of homelessness on our neighborhood street. So we do both of those things. We're trying to keep the balance of offering services, at the same time realizing that we can't have tents popping up in our cul-de-sac here or anywhere, you know, on this side of the bridge. But very near close, of course, Hell's Trail and Camp Paradise are these opportunities for people to camp. So really wanting to talk to Sandy, City Council. Actually, we had meetings with a month and a half ago, one with the Mayor Bruner. We had scheduled meetings with both Renee Golder and Shibra, I can never remember her last name, Kalantari Johnson.
Correct.
And never any replies from Martine Watkins or Donna Myers. And we have a weird relationship with Justin Cummings from 2 years ago because he said, we're not going to do camping in Santa Cruz. And I said, all we're going to do is fucking camping in Santa Cruz. And he, you know, there was an argument between he and I. Of course, I don't advocate for citywide camping, but we as a community and a government have to just finally swallow the pill and realize that's what's happening. And clearly that's what's happening. So, But we're doing it in the worst way possible. Either we have these lucky people who get plucked out and to go into one of these, these ordained encampments, special camps, or you're trapped in the worst case scenario of all that you would never want your sister or family member to be residing in. Everybody we know who are in these camps feel like they're under torture, under threat, under an oppressive environment. It's just the worst.
I know some who probably would not say that, but then again, those are your experiences with the folks you know, right?
Oh no, I the folks I know pretty much everybody. So if they're not one of those people, then those are the people who are creating the aggression, damage, and oppression. Either you're oppressed or you're the oppressor in these spaces. Almost nobody's having a good time in the benchlands.
So you said you met with Councilmember Brown, but were not terribly happy with that meeting?
I was very happy with Brown. She understands everything that we're going through, our experience, got to, share, our perceptions, the city manager's office all the way through what they're doing and why. Why didn't they choose AFC or, we've been advocating simultaneously for these opportunities to do transitional camps. Why didn't they choose AFC and or Warming Center to run a transitional camp? It would take the burden off the city, and then we can demonstrate something that we've been studying for a very long time. We've been studying this, traveled the West Coast numerous times, practically wrote the book on this type of encampment. It still isn't existing here. So it was really nice to talk with her, kind of develop maybe some, just first of all, sometimes you have to just, you know, get some agreement about the landscape, talk about what the terrain looks like, and then slowly build a plan of how to traverse, you know, into the future, what that'll look like, and what, you know, she's got the Micah Posner single vote now. Sometimes she does work with Justin, you know, it's 5-2 every time they lose every vote on homelessness, that is, you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes she's the lone.
Yeah, that's never impressed me much, because I think that a single council member can do a great deal in terms of staff reports and things of that sort. But, you know, that's never, it didn't impress me with Micah. It hasn't impressed me with Sandy Brown. But you said you got a positive sense of the communication with her, right?
Well, it's mainly just, you know, what's the game plan? You know, first of all, when you've been waiting for years, when you wait every few years for these opportunities that the city always just, you know, tosses it off the table into the waste bin over and over and over. You know, why now? The big question now is, why would they have issued a request for qualifications for nonprofits to operate camps and then not choose any of the nonprofits to operate camps and then decide at the last minute to go it alone? Why would they do that? You know, and why is the community not asking these questions? There's nobody. I'll say nobody, not even you, saying, why is the city running a transitional camp and not AFC or Brent?
You know, well, I think I know the answer to that one. I mean, I think...
why is it? Why do you think?
They don't trust either of you or like either of you. That's, you know, for unjustifiable reasons. And also, they are primarily in the hands of a reactionary... I don't want to say constituency, although some of it is a constituency. You know, it's a reactionary city council, and they're concerned with essentially pleasing a certain portion of the city.
No, but the city council didn't make this decision.
Well,
the city council. Here's what's been happening. Everybody blames on the city council.
Well, they empowered the city manager to make the decision.
Yeah. So even the RFQ process, even the TOLO process. These are staff reports and staff recommendations. Every single time, go all the way down through the beginning of the temporary outdoor living ordinance. That wasn't crafted by Donna Myers. She was one of the creators, but this is in partnership with city staff. So again, you know, we had to call them out. Why would they say that they wanted to put people in Arana Gulch, Moore Creek, you know, De La Viega, and the Pogonip, when there hadn't been any community support for those things? Then why would they do the opposite and put people on city streets like they do in San Francisco when there was zero support for it? Who's crafting this bullshit? And then finally, why would they just dump people back in the benchlands and then try to operate their own homeless camp, transitional camp, when they haven't done one single thing that has worked in years?
Well, they like to pretend.
Like I'm saying, there's no critical analysis.
Well, they like to pretend they have. That's the point, I think. You know, they operate on paper, is what they do. That's my sense of it. I mean, they have this elaborate OVO ordinance, the oversized vehicle ordinance, that actually has very few spaces for oversized vehicles that currently exist. Although I was going to ask you about that, whether you had any updates on the Association of Faith Communities' so-called safe parking program.
So I've had to finally, this is rare for me because I like to, you know, to know and defend all things around homelessness. I've decided to keep my voice out of the OVO issue. I did have a lot to say prior to it because I think our community has been wrong every step of the way. What we do is we don't have a community voice based on awareness, will, we don't have a vision. So the city always is concocting stupid shit, and then we are always there stuck protesting stupid shit. So with the OVO, we as a community had a lot to say along the way, but we always end up kind of in that moment, you know, the Abby Samuels, complaint moment, or that we're going to do finally, which is really good. We like to see community groups like Santa Cruz Cares and Jesus Christ.
Well, there's the ACLU, which is challenging the
ACLU. Right, ACLU. But still, that's still us, these organizations, coming in after the fact because the community itself had no voice on the issue. And that's, so I'm very frustrated with the community at large. And that's kind of where I'm doubling back now. We've had all these opportunities. We get none of them. Jeremy Leonard, of all people, the last person ever to run a transitional camp, is running a transitional camp, and he's not there. So it's just the thing is already off the rails.
And describe why you feel Leonard is not the man for the camp.
Because I think personally he's not I got to be very careful here, but he's been a very good friend of mine. He's thrown me under the bus twice for his own career, for these opportunities. And you get these opportunities to do things. Instead, it could have been so good. We could have worked together for the benefit of people who suffer outside. He really just wanted to buy that $75,000 boat. He told me he was just taking this work to buy that boat, and then he's out of here. And what he really, just watching him on his Facebook page, where he's on one hand, he's doing things that you could never really do as a professional. On the one hand, cast himself as this hero, saving lives with Narcan, and, oh, you're great, Jeremy, you're amazing. And on the other hand, saying fucked up shit about the people in the camps that he oversees. This polarity just describes him, and I've watched him personally. He's not there because he cares about people. He's just earning that paycheck, and it's just, he's a city functionary of the benchlands, the city benchlands situation, where they should not be a benchlands after benchlands after benchlands, where the city is constantly blaming the people in the benchlands every year and then building another one the following year. If you just chart this in the way the conversation goes, so he's now running one. It's just kind of like, I don't want, like, saying all the negative things I would say, but I don't trust him. I don't think he's a person of integrity, lacks authenticity, and is just and shouldn't be doing a transitional camp. Transitional camps are for people who, they're philosophy based. It's not about, the contract is one thing, but it's that you believe in the inherent value of the individual and the opportunity for transformation. So instead of a managed camp where you're babysitting people based on, hiring people to watch people every minute, you're actually going to give people the credit, personal opportunity to take care of their space. Yes, that goes really bad if it's not done right, like in this case. The reason it goes really well in the Northwest is because you have these humanitarian-oriented, philosophy-based nonprofits running transitional camps up there in Eugene, Portland, Seattle, where they, we're going to build a community of support. And we're going to support that community with this nonprofit. So that's what's the missing sauce, special sauce, is that the city shouldn't be running. And just what they've done is they opened it, they gave them a set of rules, and now they've kind of left them to fend for themselves. There's no there. You need the nonprofit in the space every day. Every day.
Let me ask you again.
You need a weekly meeting.
The question. Let me interrupt you for a moment here, Brent, because I guess I'm kind of trying to do this in little pieces to some extent. When I asked you about the Association of Faith Communities Safe Parking Program, I wasn't, necessarily going off into a critique of the OVO, which I've done endlessly anyway, but rather I'm trying to understand the current facilities that exist for RVs in the city as claimed by the city. Even through
I'm not the right guy to ask that question to.
You haven't got any sense of that, or
no. I mean, we like the way the AFC is running under contract the safe parking program, and it needs to be more robust. I have not read the OVO how the city's working with the AFC, or if there's other opportunities for other nonprofits, or if they're just going to. Do you know?
Well, the last thing I heard about the Association of Faith Communities was the head of the program. I heard two things. One, that the head of the program, Jacobs, whatever his name is,
Jacobs.
He was unwilling to, even to his own employees, to give sufficient information about accessibility and space when they asked him about it. That's hence one of them quit, Mel Nunes. Another situation is that when the city council announced it was providing great support to the AFC, he called in, you may remember this, and he said, "You're not giving me any support. This is not true." And I found this rather surprising because, you know, here's a guy who's hired or gets grants from the city anyway. So,
AFC has been very, I can't speak to the AFC. I just know what I've been told is that the city's been pretty much non-communicado with them, like they are with us. You have these opportunities and they actually will say something in the press that's not true, even relating to their interaction with the nonprofit.
Yeah, no, and that's quite possible. I guess with the OVO appeal coming up to the Planning Commission and then forward to the City Council and finally to the Coastal Commission, I'm curious to find out what kind of spaces RVs actually have here. And I can't get it directly from the AFC unless maybe I should sneak in as an employee.
It's a real bummer because, you know, there's fewer space, there's less space than there ever has been within the city. There just aren't a lot of spaces. So when you kind of survey the ground about where these things could happen, if they're not going to be, you know, reaching out to the faith communities at large, the city properties are very few. You know, you have the courtyard. That's underutilized. That could be a really good, beneficial place. And that's what I would have expected, the courtyard out on River Street. But then, you know, once you get past that, there just aren't a lot of places. They don't have access to these unused corporate parking lots on the west side. The state properties, they don't have access to any of that space. The county's not playing ball. They could talk about Emmeline. You know, that's not available. So it's really problematic, and I'm glad I'm not involved with that at all. It's hard enough to talk about locations for transitional camps. They just don't exist in the way they had, 10 years ago.
Have you, what's been your, and I know you've been, you know, pretty much rooted in what's been going on here, but have you gotten any further reports from Portland, Seattle, and so forth, Eugene?
Yeah, watching Eugene just keeps getting all these places. Wherever they had a tent city, they now have a tiny house community. They just, they've been so successful and they're working. The nonprofits have been cycling through. Some of them didn't work too well. They were too activist-oriented or demanding that the residents of the camp show up at city council meetings to protest. Things that are a little bit, you know, shady, like I believe ShareWheel, who had been the Nicholsville nonprofit. But the other nonprofits, for instance, community-supported shelters in Eugene, I think they're Nightingale, and then so we're talking about Seattle and Eugene here. The successful ones in Seattle, their budget has been totally eclipsed, 100% where the city pays for the budget of, I believe, formerly tent encampments that are now all tiny house villages. But Seattle's amazing, right? It's very large footprint, wide-ranging geographically, all over the place. If you look at the footprint of Seattle, Washington, it's just ridiculously huge with so many different micro-neighborhoods with little city properties all over the place. So it's very beneficial and easy for them. And then churches came forward with extra property. Santa Cruz is tiny. And it's a tiny city in a county that is very long, with that little jag out to San Lorenzo Valley. So it's a really weird place. You need the community involvement here. The cities and counties have to turn themselves inside out and stop being so dominant, so jealously and so controlling of this issue. The missing special sauce is the community at large, the opportunity for the individuals and community groups to participate. Hold on a second here. Give me one moment. Hello. Hi. I'll meet you out in the breezeway. So, you know, that's the problem with Santa Cruz, is the city and the county control everything, and they don't want to play the humanitarian philosophy game. They just want to, you know, they want to do as little as possible, use the money themselves. You know, you know about this Laird multi-millions, right, coming in? John Laird got, what, $14 million coming in? And there's no real plan for nonprofits like ours to appeal for that money, so they're just going to make the decision. And there's more coming. They're going to give most of it to AFC. I'm sorry, Housing Matters. They're giving many millions for the improvement of their hygiene bay. And what they want to do is, on the horizon, build a day services program or services. And the question is where to develop that. Salvation Army going to do it, AFC, our nonprofit, something within Encompass, or Downtown Streets team. It's largely going to go to Matters, I think, is the problem.
Any comments about Housing Matters and in its progress over the last few months, or its retrogression, or whatever?
I mean, I have to be careful there. It's, you know, they are following strictly the opportunity of the federal government for permanent supportive housing, even though it's broken and it doesn't work. You need a miracle worker like Sibley Simon to come through and build a giant tower of apartments. You need. What they've been able to do is, you know, through the opportunity of, you know, creating housing, how do you end homelessness, house them? They have, the community at large has dumped uncounted, unimaginable millions on that nonprofit. They get their property for and they've been able to buy that very expensive, Victorian house across the street, which they've totally renovated, for seven people only to live in it. That's a lot. They've purchased the light industrial, the roll-up part of the automotive building across the street. You know, and they have their budget totally, paid for anyway. And we've only seen them reduce services. So it's just, it's a challenge for somebody like me, you know, but, you know, because I direct a homeless services program, let's just keep doubling down on services, finding ways to be more and more efficient, low cost, reach out to the community for help and support, because we don't get any of that money. But, you know, the does donate, and that, you know, that's, so we're challenged in a competitive market to tell a different story that's dwarfed by Housing Matters. So that's the reality for us. But I don't comment directly a lot on what they're up to. Other than that.
Except in these occasional netcasts here.
I don't have, that's pretty general. More specifically, they changed their mission statement to reflect the national paradigm of housing first. Locally, it's broken. The grand jury report is clear. I can't do it, I'm sorry. Open on very specific hours tonight between 5 and 7. Yep, I'm so I'm closed now. Sorry. So, it's out there. Every city's having this problem, following the money. Every nonprofit has this challenge, following, orienting towards the big opportunities rather than what's actually happening on the street level of homelessness in your town. And so that's our game here. And then even those left of me, these other, these new entities, Sanitation for the People, Love Boat, DSAs, Santa Cruz Care, things like that, kind of picking up the scraps in these spaces around, more humanitarian values. But what's available, it's still a competitive market to reach out to the people and tell and offer services. Sometimes they're very performative, virtue signaling behaviors. And let's just get down to business and talk about what people need and how do we improve life on the street for people. And that's kind of what we need to do. We're not even talking about, the fiasco that Food Not Bombs finds themselves in perpetually.
What's happened to the Dakota Landing folks? I understand they kind of moved up into higher ground in the benchlands. Is that...
No, those are the people primarily that have been building that community, and those are mostly the people who are now in the city's transitional camp. Those are our people.
In 1220 River, you mean?
Yeah, we should be running that camp. Those are our people from Harvey West down to the thing. They affirmed the value of protecting each other and building community around a set of values, and now they're up And the problem is they've also been joined by other people who Jeremy liked from the Benchrands camp. And so they have some real problems with theft right now. They don't have a way to keep people's belongings safe. So,
and that was, you say,
to
more...
To answer your question, the people at Dakota Landing, some of them are still in the Benchlands, but a lot of them are in 1220 River Street. Hmm.
Have you been spending any time visiting 1220 River?
I stop in maybe once a week. Yeah, it's weird because if you recall, years ago we wanted to build a transitional camp there, and Susie O'Hara blocked me from even being allowed to go there. They would scream at me, call me a paparazzi, and I'm like, you know, in every city where there's a transitional camp, you get to have a guided tour and be welcomed in. In Santa Cruz, you're treated like, you know, marauding, like I'm trying to break the space or something. So, but this one, you approach the gate. There's nobody at the gate. You walk in at all hours of the day. Nobody interacts with you. You get to approach any tent. You get to take a shower. There's nobody stopping you from doing anything in the current 1220 River Street. It's astounding. So, you know, in some way of looking at it, it's very free and open. But it's not a safe community. It's not a way to keep your belongings safe in your tent. It's not a way to build community.
You may have heard about Susie O'Hara's recent lawsuit against the city.
Oh, my God. Yeah, what a brittle spirit she is.
Tell me, what's your reaction to that?
She's evil. So there's two stories there, right? One is the one that we know about of how she took down and acted like a victim around the behavior of Drew Glover.
Mm-hmm.
And there just wasn't any there.
I didn't think so.
You know, she wasn't able to show any aggression. So it all just seemed to be ridiculous. But really what was happening that we didn't know was that the city manager's office was trying to squeeze her out. And she was refusing to go. And so she's claiming, what's the term, something that...
hostile working environment.
Yeah, hostile environment. So that might be true. And does she have the right to sue the city for $1.5 million? Wow. You know, there's no loyalty, you know. And now nobody's from here. You know, you got all these people working at the very top levels of city government who are from elsewhere, and the people who are from here sue the city that they've been working for. There's no value. There's no authenticity. There's no there. It just feels like a bunch of shit. And so we as Santa Cruzans, I believe, should have something to say about this in the future. Who are we? Like a story about who we are. What do we demand? And how do we build a story there so that this fuckery will begin orienting towards our will rather than us always being in the stupid position of having to, as I say, protest stupid shit year after year after year. It's time we wrote the script as community members and, you know, to put ourselves back in the driver's seat. There's that book I like to point to called Leftmost City, published in 2009. Just prior to or during the, you know, beginning of Take Back Santa Cruz, prior to the Occupy Santa Cruz movement. So the book didn't really get much play because we were changing the story right at the moment we needed to know that previous story. We remembered our Santa Cruz values, what we're about, why we came here, what unified us, and... I don't want to say take back, but just, you know, remember who we are so we can begin of the new Santa Cruz. We're going to need to do this now because all these giant buildings are coming in. A bunch of new people are going to come to Santa Cruz. They're going to claim that value set also. They're here for a reason. There's a legacy that we need to uphold here of progressive values, even, you know, freaky psychedelia, the whole deal, the whole... thing that Santa Cruz represents. And if it's just going to be, you know, a t-shirt and a bumper sticker, it's not going to be good enough, and we're all going to have to leave because it's just going to be worse than ever.
I know that when you were working with Sanctuary Village and the Warming Center, You amassed a lot of supporters. Are they still in a position to join you in raising these issues in a significant way?
It's really funny because when it comes to authenticity and integrity, I went too far. Instead of building a movement to demand things of the city, we decided to build programs and have these people support us, volunteer with us, donate. And turning that around into some sort of political social movement, populist movement to demand things from the city has always felt weird and wrong. So I wanted to build the Coalition on Homelessness and able to do that. But I found myself fractured. I can't do all this at once. But now, you know, we're starting this movement called We Are Santa Cruz, hosted by the Coalition on Homelessness. We had our first Begin the Beginning meeting last week. Unfortunately, I was sick as I presented the vision of the meeting. And, you know, it's going to be a slow build over the next month, 2 months. And it shouldn't be the Brent show, but what it starts with the capstone of awareness. So it will be me sharing a lot of what we've experienced as a nonprofit. We have collective, we forget really what has happened even over the last year around homelessness. You know, here we are in this OVO moment. We don't even remember the beginning of what they were proposing, and the Battle of the Duck Pond, and why were people up at the Duck Pond in the first place? Because they were forced out of the benchlands. Why were they at the benchlands? Over and over, right? We need to chart that history and be aware of what's been happening so that we can say, you know, this isn't appropriate. What does most of Santa Cruz choose around people camping in our parks?
When is your next meeting of this group, and is it open to the public?
Yeah. So it was, I didn't publicize it well, although it was, you did get an email, I'm sure of it, because you're on some of our email lists.
Not that I know of, but maybe I did. Yeah.
Things mostly on Google listservs now, they go to people's junk files.
Ah.
Yeah, and now everyone's organized through Instagram. So the old Google Groups thing doesn't work and is effectively anymore. But, you know, it's you know, Santa Cruz Cares has, and other groups have come onto the fore. Kayla Kumar and others, Joyce Hindle-Decker and others, and, you know, the perennial favorite, Keith McHenry, Robert Norse. You know, how do we coalesce our vision? And how do we realize that maybe some of our vision has been reactionary to a city? It's been idiotic. You know, so reflecting our recent past around homelessness, and I like to offer our nonprofits experience. I think everyone would be very fascinated to know what we've been trying to do over many years, what the city-county response to us has been. We just say, oh, they don't like you, they don't like us, oh, Brent's an asshole, but look at all this other shit that the nonprofit's been doing, carrying free and manifesting out of virtually nothing. You know, I think the community has something that would like to know about this, and we want to, you know, the question is, if Robert, 5 years ago, if we knew what was happening now, we were forecasting it 5 years ago, we wouldn't have believed it. A lot of us expected that there's going to be an economic downturn and that we were going to see the cities lined with tents, right? Streets lined with tents. Well, we're seeing it now, but it's not the way it could have been. What's going to happen from now, and what would our vision be? Do we have something to say? That's what we're trying to spark now. Do people have the right to camp in city parks? Do you want people to camp on your street? You know, because a lot of us have people camping on our street. Is it appropriate that in one entire downtown park is inundated completely and that the other parks are held vacant? You know, how do we disperse this more equitably around the city? How do we create spaces that aren't beckoning for every addict in the entire county to come move in next to the dealer? How do we change that dynamic so that it's just people who really are forced outside and have no other opportunity? Why is it the dealers that are now running these spaces, the most aggressive people?
So again, when is your next meeting, if you have it planned?
I have not scheduled it yet.
I got you.
We're building a steering committee, so it's not just me, but, you know, it's, again, I have to jumpstart it myself. But it'll be a group not chaired by me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always good to see collective leadership if you can do it. You know, it's good.
Right. You know, the question is, we have to just, again, do we believe it? Do we believe a thing? What's possible? Also, we're so busy, and homelessness is just saps, you know, and I use your name, I use your name as a negative device a lot of the time. I say it's been Norse to death, right, over decades. And you probably don't like hearing that.
Mm.
You know, I don't mean a personal attack on you, but that's my reflection. If you take Santa Cruz as a kind of a big circle of population, the extreme right, the haters who want more cops and want people to be driven out, or the extreme left, who are always saying, Funat Bomb should be able to take over any space, people should be able to camp anywhere they damn well please. Not everybody in the center, the larger population, agrees with those sentiments. But what ends up happening is the extremes always have too much of a voice, so most of the people in Santa Cruz are left with nothing to say, not even invited to the conversation. So it's time to, begin talking about what most of Santa Cruz would prefer. I believe we're a left liberal, compassionate, progressive town, at least mostly left. And I think we have something to say that isn't defined by what Keith McHenry is saying about homelessness. Thanks for being so generous. I appreciate you.
Oh, no, it's good hearing it. I think you have, frankly, far too much confidence in the people in the middle. Although I understand that these are key folks in many ways. Still, sometimes the truth is at one of the extremes. That's what I think.
What we've learned here is the reason I have 1,000 blankets this season to give away is because they've been donated by people we never met before.
Right on.
People volunteer who we never met before. They're not. They don't place themselves on the political spectrum to volunteer. When they send me $200 in checks or $5 in the mail, they don't place themselves on the political spectrum. They're people, the residents of Santa Cruz, who believe that we're doing good work and they want to see it continue. And those are the people we need to really activate.
Well, it's interesting. You know, McHenry is throwing an event in early March thanking the people of Santa Cruz, and he is saying exactly the same thing you are about the donations that came into Food Now Bombs. So
yep.
Maybe you're both right, and I should ponder the whole situation. And I will before my next, or maybe I'll just forget the whole thing. But I'll be putting this out so people can hear what your thoughts are, and I think I liked it, so thank you.
Health to you.
Yeah, you too, man. You're the one who sounds like you could use some health.
Drinking tequila. To ease
the pain.
Tonight is the first night I've actually decided that I'm better, so it's nice to talk with you, shoot the shit.
Well, I appreciate your candor, and I hope it gets out there in ways that are helpful to all of us, you know. Boy, do I sound like a politician. I better shut up.
A populist hero.
Oh, boy. All right, well, listen, if people want to reach you, Brad, what can they do?
WarmingCenterProgram@gmail.com, WarmingCenterProgram.com. My personal desk is 588-9892. The hotline is 246-1234. Warming Center Program, and we do footbridge services every single day of the week. And we haven't closed one day during the pandemic.
Good. Be talking with you again. Call me when you want.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Be well.
And now, as if you weren't tired enough of listening, but perhaps you're not, here's a flashback to May 27th, 1999. I like to keep, cram everything I can into these broadcasts or netcasts. You're going to hear me doing a lengthy wrap-up of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. That's the precursor to the Housing Mutters or Housing Matters 115 Coral Street operation. A poverty pimp palace for some. I wouldn't call it really a palace. But it certainly is a fund magnet and does not serve the entire homeless community. and operates under the facade of, or perhaps the delusion of, a so-called creating a pathway to housing for homeless folks. So there's also, this was the period of Clinton's Yugoslavian bombing in 1999, and the Santa Cruz Police Department's mass arrest of protesters and Officer David Lefevre's assault on activist Steve Argue, who eventually went to jail for a year, but didn't stop being an activist nonetheless. And he was actually, Lefevre was found in the only instance where there was actually an independent investigation by the Citizens Police Review Board before it was unceremoniously guillotined by the city council 4 years later. An independent investigation that found Officer David Lefevre guilty of excessive force. Not that the police department did anything about it. I think he moved on very soon to another department in the South Bay somewhere. You can hear me talking about Douglas, Anthony Douglas, the street spirit vendor who was busted for selling street spirits on the street, illegal activity, but one which apparently annoyed either merchants or police or some bureaucrat. And we were actually, I think we successfully defended him and changed that policy somewhat. Though Clark's, that's Steve Clark's Marauders, he was a particularly hostile and reactionary police official, high police official. He became eventually deputy chief, but was moved on to harass some other community. Then you get to hear a lengthy interview with Lou Rice, who was a homeless protester who did a fast in front of the post office. Those were the days, you know, when they didn't have it fenced off. Ah, those days before the fences, anything to keep those homeless people away from the good people, which is getting worse, by the way. But it's interesting to listen to him. And then he and I, or an earlier me anyway, question Councilmember Mike Rotkin, who was still on the council in a minority position. These were the days after the city council was composed of progressives, a progressive majority, supposedly. But very soon the progressive majority had showed its face by refusing to even moderate the sleeping ban in ways that would impact people during the winter and protect women and so forth by limiting it in ways that obviously could have been done, as you can see by what's been happening recently over the last few years. It's actually hasn't been changed in law. In fact, the law in 2022 is now going to be worse, or is worse. It's on the books. It just isn't being officially and citywide enforced, or at least I've not received reports of it happening now. But as I say, Rotkin was in the minority, and that probably gave him, more motivation to talk. Although we've had many, numerous conversations on the air. I think he likes debating, he likes the public limelight. As I suppose I do. In any case, that's the 2 hours you're going to hear, I think maybe even 2.5 hours, way back in May of 1999. Enjoy. If you have comments, if you want to be involved in any HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom projects, if you have any questions, feel free to give me a call, 831-423-4833 is my number. And, as I say, enjoy.